I'm
Go.
Peg Church. I live in Bethlehem. Recently, the senator from Alaska and the senator from West Virginia, both of different political parties, have spoken about climate issues, and they reached across the aisle and have been working together to some degree. I'm wondering what your thoughts or projections are on that happening more in the regards to the climate concerns that the White House, when they first came in, they took climate off of their website. It was not, climate change was not a topic.
You are seeing individual senators working across the aisle on aspects of climate change, on even aspects of immigration, on issues around childcare, on specific issues. You still don't see it working in a bigger way. I mean, you did see with the vote just last week on the part of Republicans in the House and then Republicans in the Senate to go against the president on declaring a national emergency in order to transfer money to build a border wall, which, of course, he vetoed, and it's going to happen because they don't have enough votes to override his veto. But you are seeing in bits and pieces, in corners here and there, working across the aisle. You talk, honestly, if you talk to an individual member of Congress, Republican or Senate, not all of them, but most of them have good friends in the other party. But you would never know it to listen to the language, to listen to the angry rhetoric coming out of Washington. So much of it, or the White House, it's so much of it is just, it's just almost computer generated. It's just, you know, they open their mouth and they're all bad guys. No, they're all bad guys and girls, and that's the way it is. But they do, one-on-one, they do talk to each other. They work with each other. But they are under some constraints to stick with their party, which is another whole story. It's a lot of how Washington has changed over the last few decades. Washington, when I came to town in the 1970s, my husband and I used to say you'd go out to a dinner and there would be Republicans and Democrats, and you'd have a good, lively conversation. Today, you don't see that. You either go to a Republican event or you go to a Democratic event. They just don't hang out together. The party conferences control more of their time. They have structured party luncheons so that the members can't have a few free moments to go fraternize with somebody in the other political party, and they all rush home. Most of them rush home on the weekends to be with their district or their state, and there's a good reason for that to some extent, but it's taken away from those friendships and those relationships that used to be in Washington.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to speak to us here at Lehigh. My name is Evan Chansky, and I'm a junior studying electrical engineering. You talked a lot about how to talk with people that have differing opinions. And there's a phenomenon that I've noticed with national politics and also campus issues as well, that there's a subset of the population that isn't as engaged in conversations. Either they're ambivalent or apathetic or don't feel like they want to voice their opinions. How would you kind of suggest talking to people that aren't as engaged in conversation?
Well, look, I mean, the reality is not everybody's going to want to engage and talk. I mean, some people just go about their lives and they're busy and they're dealing with whether it's school or raising a family or their career, their job, or making ends meet and holding down two or three jobs. They barely have time to have even the luxury, you might call it, of thinking about some of these questions that we are so lucky to be able to talk about tonight. So I'm under no illusion that everybody's got to be part of this conversation. But for those who can participate and who want to participate, there just has to be a way to first of all, I think it starts with listening. It starts with listening to the other side and understanding that not all wisdom resides in one political philosophy or another. I know that's hard for some folks with very, very strong political views to accept. And I'm not so naive as to think, oh, yeah, we're going to do away with all, you know, people in the hard left or the hard right who believe what they do. I understand that. But it's just that thinking has crept into more and more of our political community to the point that people who at one point, you know, were open to other ideas are now saying, well, I don't want to hear anything else. I just want to hear, and I want to know only about that. And that's what I think we have to guard against. And maybe it means having some really tough conversations in your own family I can't tell you how many people have told me now how hard it is to go home at Thanksgiving or Easter or Christmas or whatever holiday you observe and talk to family members who have a different political view. I mean, that I think is emblematic of what's going on. But I think, you know, it, just start around the margin. Start with a neighbor. Start with your, you know, the student down the hall you've been meaning to talk to, or somebody in the workplace, a neighbor. I just think it's something we need to take on as a people in this country. And yes, it would be great if we had a leader who was saying, "Let's talk to each other." And again, I'm not saying strong views are going to go away. People are going to have strong views, but we don't have to do it in a way where we demonize the other side. That, to me, is what makes the difference.
Yes. So I appreciate everything you had to say, especially relating to the press. And my observation, my question is inspired by my observation of the press lately. And that is, when one vested interest group or another picks up and bandies around an epithet to stoke anger and widen distance between positions, do you think the press, in quotes, can do things to diffuse inflammatory rhetoric without losing market share or the actual mission of reporting the news?
Well, in public media, we don't worry about market share. I mean, we do want people to watch and listen. That's really important to NPR and to PBS. So that's not an equation for me. I can address the commercial side of it in a moment. But you asked if it's our role to defuse. Our role is to report. It's to cover. I'm sorry, did you say something else?
Can you?
Can we? Our role is to report and to observe, to share with the public widely what's being said without either exaggerating it or making it or ignoring it. So if it's happening, and I wish I could think of a great example right now, maybe you have one, then we ought to be talking about it, but not beating the drums and making it worse than it is. So that's not our role. That's not what we do. That's not to say there aren't people on television or on the internet or in social media who aren't happy to beat the drums and whip up a fever. For some people, that's, you know, they love doing that. That's part of their mission in life, at least right now. So, but that's not what journalists I know and the journalists I respect, that's not who we are. That's not what we do. So, yes, to answer your question. And then you're asking, are some doing it in order to increase their eyeballs, numbers, audience share? I can't answer that question. I mean, I can observe and I can say, maybe if you covered this a little bit less, people wouldn't be so worked up about it. But I don't, you know, I'm reluctant to ascribe motives to people in other news organizations and to point fingers and say, well, you're definitely doing this in order to in order to stir up a fight. I think individuals are. I'm not ready to accuse entire news organizations of doing that.
I'm particularly interested in terminology that kind of gets bandied around, like progressive and socialistic or reactionary. And it becomes descriptive, but not necessarily accurate.
Well, I think we need to stick to the facts. We need to stick to what's known. And if one candidate is saying another candidate is Bernie Sanders himself says I'm a democratic socialist. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said she has some beliefs that are socialist. So if they say that and if their views are that, that's one thing. But just to repeat epithets, no, that's not what we should be doing.
First off, I want to thank you for coming and speaking with us today. My name is Will Newbegin. I'm a sophomore and a journalist here at Lehigh. My question surrounds, how do you think we cultivate a news literacy among the U.S. population in a news market where there seems to be new sources of news, whether they're, legitimate or not, kind of, left and right?
That's a great question. I think what you do is you write about the things that are important in really interesting ways to get people's attention. You know, write about what's going on in the schools, in the public schools in your community. Write about what's going on with regard to the environment. Write about, I'm just picking things out of the air. Write about, you know, why some businesses are struggling to stay open. Write about why some people are having a hard time getting a job. Write about healthcare issues. Write about them in ways, and write about them in ways that show you're really interested in that and you really care about it, and that will come across in your reporting. That's the way to get people to read the news, or to watch the news. If you write about it in a way that's rote and, oh, I've got to do this and I've got to do this, then it's not, people are not, you know, they may want the information, but they want it in a way that is engaged and that will capture, you know, their interest in their, and maybe even their imagination. So,
how do you, going a little further with that, how do you think we, as a population, though, help people develop that critical sense when they come across something they see on Facebook that looks like a real article, you know, but actually has very little truth to it?
How do you tell the difference between what's to be trusted?
And what how do you cultivate that on a large scale?
My advice is to look always at the source. To the extent you can see, is this a source you recognize? Is it the Associated Press? Is it Reuters? These are two major news services that deploy hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands, of reporters around the world. They work very hard, anonymously often, to do good work. And then our mainstream news organizations, from New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, the major networks, the NewsHour, NPR. These are organizations that have been around for a while. You may not like what's on their editorial page, but if it's a newspaper, you may not agree with that. But in general, they're doing good reporting. They've got reporters who are working really hard to get information. And frankly, the more different sources of information you can put together, read as widely as you have time to and listen, and then make up your own mind. But do be careful about the sourcing. You know, people, if somebody sends you a post on Facebook, a link that says, you know, that the Pope, I think I used this example today, the Pope endorsed Hillary Clinton, or the Pope said, don't vote for Hillary, whatever. I mean, obviously that didn't happen, but a lot of people believe stories like that in 2016 that were just clearly off the boil. It's not always so clear cut. Sometimes it kind of sounds plausible. Maybe, you know, maybe that did happen. That's when you look at the fine print. But it's a challenge. I don't underestimate. I mean, you've got to take the time to look. You've got to look at the top of the story, look at the bottom of the story. You know, use your judgment and be discerning. Hold these news organizations accountable. Yeah.
Hello. My name is Tyler Longo. I'm a third-year engineering student at Lehigh University. Firstly, I'd like to say thank you for having such a wonderful, influential person speaking, so thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And now to get to my question. Like most of my generation, within my family, there is a political divide. And based off the title, I'd like to ask about how to start a dialogue with someone with an opposing opinion in the effort of reconciliation, even when there is strong demonization of the opposing sides.
It's a great question, because I just talked about it, but I didn't talk about how to do it. I start with listening, and I'm asking questions. I think you sit down with this family member, maybe over a cup of coffee or a glass of whatever you like to drink, Diet Coke, a glass of wine, I don't know, bourbon, and say, you know, I'd like to have a conversation about the differences that we have over, you know, a couple of things. And tell me, you know, how did you come to that view? Where have you always felt that way? Was that something that you grew up believing? Was there something that changed your thinking on it? Where did that strong opinion come from? And listen and wait and try to draw them out. I think I've observed this among other people, and sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. But I think it's worth it, especially if it's your own family and you're with people who love each other but can hardly have a conversation. It's really tough when that happens. But I think maybe that's the way to do it. You know, a cup of coffee, of scotch on the rocks, but listen, ask questions and listen. You may not change the other person's mind, but maybe you'll at least be able to come to a point where you can have a conversation about it, tolerate each other's presence. But in all seriousness, come to a place where you remember the humanity in each of you. Remember that the other person is still someone to be respected and loved if it's a family member, even if that person has a very different view. But it's a wonderful question, and I think it's occurring in so many, many, many American families right now.
I definitely agree with your opinion on love, and I feel like that's very important with family. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Hi, Edie Ritter. I'm a Lehigh alumni, and I have noticed that, and others I'm sure, that the primaries have become so polarized, and there's been an exiting of the moderates from the political arena because of the attacks that are mounting in primaries. Is there anything that can be done about that? Can the media do it? Is there any way we can change that?
That the parties have become so...
So polarized that the moderate candidates no longer are coming to the fore.
It's another great question, and we've watched it over time. We've watched the moderates in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party just slowly fade away. The Bill Bradleys, who, by the way, I guess was a Kenner lecturer a few years ago, I'm trying to think, John Kasich, who, of course, went on to run for governor of Ohio. There was a time when I could list about 8 or 10 moderates in each party, but there are very few. I mean, today you think in the Republican Party and you think of Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, perhaps Pat Toomey here in Pennsylvania on some issues, and then a number. Okay, all right. I was trying to get local. but you do, I mean, you do see, to get back to the first question that was asked over here, you do see some Republicans and Democrats working across the aisle. Some Republicans especially, it's notable because normally they're not invited to work with the other party. It's something that they, you know, they face ostracism or having... You know, losing their committee assignments, losing money from the party, having somebody primary them. So, but you're absolutely right. It's happened, but it goes back several decades. This is not something that just happened like this, that we suddenly became far apart. It's been building. And I think it probably does go hand in hand with this conversation we're having about lack of civility and division in the country. People in the middle are just getting drowned out in this invective, these, you know, yelling at each other from far left to far right and right to left. And people who want to say, wait a minute, you know, have you thought about this as another path? What about compromise? What about, you know, those people have been basically disinvited to the party. they're not welcome. And it's true in both parties. I mean, the Democrats have not welcomed folks in the center either. It's happened in both parties. So do I have a solution personally for what to do about it? I think some of it has to do with what we're talking about tonight in respecting others. And I didn't mention this, but I mean, frankly, that in viewing compromise is not a dirty word. Compromise is not a... It's not... It's not always the answer. Sometimes tough stands have to be taken and people have to be made angry and so forth because they didn't get their way. But in general, I mean, as you think back over, I mean, I think back over what Lyndon Johnson did to get the Civil Rights Act passed, what Ronald Reagan did to get the tax cuts passed. I mean, compromise, And that was, you know, for a long time, that was just the way it was done. That's gotten distorted over time as we've moved past those, you know, those, I guess, rose color, as we watch those times through rose-colored glasses. But right now, there are very few moderates, as you describe them. You're absolutely right. I wish
WLVR, Bethlehem.
My name is Sally Sayre. I'm a retired school teacher. And my question is, where do you find these wonderful women journalists that you have on PBS? I love Lisa Desjardins explains it all for you, what goes on at the Senate. Amna Nawaz is doing amazing reporting, especially from the border, and she's very balanced. She talks to, you know, one side and talks to the other. She tries to give the whole picture. But also, Yamiche Alcindor, where did this young lady come from? She's amazing. She talks a little fast, but in that way, she gets a lot of information out about what's going on at the White House. So,
well, I wish I could take credit for all of them. They are amazing. In fact, I'm going to share your comment with them tomorrow morning at our morning meeting.
Please do.
They are extraordinary. I mean, we've gotten, I mean, I have to say the NewsHour has always had some pretty amazing women as well as men. We were founded by Jim Lehrer and Robin McNeil, who two guys who I owe a lot to, my mentors. So they really taught me a lot. In watching them over the years, I learned so much about journalism. But, you know, the first person they brought on board to work with them when it was just the McNeil-Lehrer Report was Charlene Hunter Gault, who was an amazing one. Many of you will remember Charlene, who, you know, who started out as a writer for the New Yorker magazine. Of course, she was a figure in the civil rights movement. She was the first, she and Hamilton Holmes were the first two students to integrate the University of Georgia in 1961. So she had her own engagement in the civil rights movement, and yet she went on to be an acclaimed journalist. And so Jim and Robin brought Charlene. Later on, I came along, but Margaret Warner has been an integral part of the show until a few years ago. But you're absolutely right. Amna came to us from ABC News. Lisa Desjardins has been with us several years covering The Hill. She came to us from CNN. Yamiche came from print journalism. She was with USA Today and then The New York Times, and we lured her into television. By the way, Jeffrey Brown does amazing arts reporting all day long and all night, covering, you know, talking to Pulitzer Prize winners and artists and musicians and just incredible work. And we've just expanded our arts coverage. I'm going to give a shout out to everybody. John Yang does an amazing job for us. William Brangham, who does, an incredible job. He just came back from Antarctica, spent a week or more than a week down there. And Nick Schifrin, who covers foreign policy for us and has been all over the world. It was a foreign correspondent for a decade before he joined us just a couple years ago. It's an amazing team. I am so lucky to work with each and every one of them. But thank you for giving them this plug. I'm going to share it with them in the morning. Thank you.
Judy, we have about 10 more minutes left, so I think we can get these last three questions and then be done.
Great.
Okay. I'm Taylor Burkhead. I graduated a few minutes ago from Lehigh. Got degrees in engineering and applied science. And as a partial answer to the questions about news and how to talk to people, I highly recommend some short videos on the Khan Academy about critical thinking. And it's, you know, 10 minutes, and it refreshed my memory on how to evaluate things. Anyway, my question is, however the Mueller report comes out, it's going to say the president's a bad guy, the president's not a bad guy, or somewhere in between. And I think that that's going to a degree, miss the point. And I'm more concerned about what was going on inside the Department of Justice and the FBI. And can you all please shine a bright light on whatever you can dig up in there? Because I'm sure that none of us want to have unelected officials running the show.
A very, very good point. And in fact, there's been attention. Congress, as you know, has been looking into what's been going on at the Department of Justice and at the FBI. I actually disagree with you. I think the Mueller, I don't know this, but my instinct is that the Mueller report is going to be about a lot more than whether the president is a good guy or the president is not a good guy. I think it's going to be a pretty detailed, comprehensive look at what happened has happened during the period of the election and any connections or not to the Russian government. So, I mean, I've observed what Mueller has done enough and knew him earlier when he was FBI director enough to know or to believe that this is going to be a very serious, thorough, lengthy, probably detailed report, and it won't be just, there will be some in the media who will take it as a, well, it's a thumbs up or a thumbs down. It's going to be more than that, and I hope we all will reflect on it and read it and think about it. Because, first of all, we don't know what's in it. I mean, I certainly don't. But I do have enough respect for Robert Mueller to think it's going to be full. And I think that's one of the reasons it's not coming out quickly, because they want to make sure they answer as many questions as they possibly can before they make something public.
I'm concerned that there are going to be a lot of reporters chasing the shiny object. So if you can focus your unbiased, truth-seeking work on what was going on in these departments, that would be great.
I appreciate the question. Thank you so much.
Hi. Thank you for coming here again. I think everybody appreciates your talk very much. This was fantastic. I'm Colin. I'm a third-year student here at Lehigh. And I wanted to ask you, obviously the talk is about the political divide in America. It's growing. You said you think this is a unique degree of political divide, at least during your career. I'm curious, do you think contributing to that is the fact that we've been seeing elections, and specifically presidential elections, elongated? You know, 2016, the first major candidate to declare for president was in March of 2015. Now we have December of 2018. Elizabeth Warren announces an exploratory committee. In 2016, the Republicans have like 20 candidates. Now that's going to be the Democrats this time around. Do you think that this elongation, these two-year election cycles for the presidency, are contributing to that more because it's just a bigger part of our time and our thinking over the course of 2 years?
I think that's a great question. I think that's part of it. But Barack Obama announced, what is it, in January, February of 2007, so that was a two-year campaign. These two-year things have gone back. It doesn't have to be that way, but there is so much at stake in these elections, and right now the Democrats are looking at this election, and they're thinking, how many of them think, I mean, if you lined up all the Democrats who think that they would be a better president than President Trump, I mean, the line would be, the length of the Senate and the House and the governors and on and on. And so they want to get their name out early. They want to get the recognition. They want to raise the money. They want to get their poll numbers up. So there are all sorts of reasons for that, not to mention the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire have the first contests in January or early February of the election year. And then you have straw polls, and you have Jefferson Jackson Day dinners, and the parties are part of this process. But I think that's a part of it. But I also think it's social media. It's the internet. It's just this sort of industry of politics. It's political consultants. There are now tens of thousands of them who make a living consulting with candidates. There are just so many ingredients that go into the stew that we're now dealing with. But I agree with you. The calendar is certainly one of them. Very good question. Thank you. Maybe one more? Okay, great.
Phil Sweet, Lehigh class of 72, and moderate Republican.
Wait a minute. You're alive? You're alive and breathing. I may just come out and just touch your arm or something.
It's an extinct species, I think. A quick recommendation on detecting false news. I highly recommend Carl Sagan's Baloney Detection Kit. Google it. Take a look. My question is, I heard a chilling quote on NPR the other day, which was that when fascism comes to the U.S., it will be called Americanism. Do you see us drifting in that direction?
No. I think certainly there's talk. I don't mean to dismiss your question. I know it's a serious question. There certainly is talk of, not just talk, but we've seen evidence of intolerance, white supremacy. Certainly anti-Semitism. We talked about, what growing instances of anti-Islam. Again, white supremacy. So I think we have to take all that seriously. There are these sort of nascent neo-Nazi groups scattered around the country. Some of my colleagues have done really chilling reporting. They've come back with chilling reports on what these groups believe. We saw it in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017. I think that we have to be vigilant as a country. I'm not ready to believe that the American people would stand for that, but I think we have to be vigilant as a people. We absolutely do, because it's between the intolerance, the ethnic divide, the religious divide that we're talking about, even the racial divide. You put it all together, and it adds up to something that could be truly harmful to what we represent as the American people. And so I hope that nothing like that, gains steam, picks up steam, gains mass. But we have to be vigilant. We have to be vigilant. Our freedom is not something we can take for granted. I've learned in the last 2 years not to take freedom of the press for granted. I think before that, I probably did, like many of my colleagues. Now, I don't do that. And I think all of us cannot take our freedom for granted. We can't take our democracy for granted. And we are seeing small signs here and there, but we have to speak up about it when we see it. We have to speak up. It's the ugliest side of what we're able to do as a people. We're able to speak out and to have different views. But when enough of those views reach a critical mass and they are intolerant and they are they're either racist or anti one particular religion or another, then we have to stand up and call it what it is. So I certainly hope not.
Thank you for your
wisdom. I certainly hope not. Thank you very much. Thank you all so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.